Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to the Cabinet of Science and Fiction.
Today we're taking a really deep dive. We're moving past just the philosophical curiosity.
Right.
And really getting into the quantitative heart of maybe the biggest meta question you could even ask.
Which is, are we living in a simulation, like a video game?
Essentially, yeah. We're tracing how this idea jumped from sci-fi, you know, The Matrix and all that, into serious scientific and philosophical debate. A lot of that momentum comes from the Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom's 2003 paper. You've probably heard of it. Are you living in a computer simulation?
I have, yeah. It really kicked things off in a big way. It sounds completely wild, like, you know, digital prisons or brains hooked up to machines.
It does sound like that initially.
But the arguments behind it, drawing on theoretical physics, computer science, they're surprisingly solid, aren't they?
They are alarmingly plausible, yes. We're looking at what Bostrom framed as a philosophical trilemma. It basically forces us down one of three paths, and each path says something pretty radical about humanity's future and, well, our current reality.
Okay, so what's our mission for this deep dive then? We're going into this trilemma.
Absolutely. We're going to rigorously unpack Bostrom's argument piece by piece. Then we'll look at some really fascinating new mathematical challenges to his probabilities, specifically around how much it might actually cost to run these simulations, especially if they start nesting inside each other.
Recursive simulations.
Yeah. And we have to tackle the Boltzmann brain problem, which is deeply weird.
I've heard that term. It sounds unsettling.
It is. It's a different kind of skepticism. And finally, we'll get into the really big picture stuff, the theological angle.
Yeah.
If this simulation idea holds water, does it mean ethics, not physics, is the real bedrock of the cosmos?
Wow. Okay. That's quite the journey. From computer processors
all the way to the nature of reality, truth, maybe even divinity.
It sounds like the answer isn't going to be a simple yes or no.
Far from it. It's much more tangled and honestly more interesting than that.
Okay, let's unpack this. So, section one, Bostrom's simulation argument. It all starts with a prediction about future technology, doesn't it?
That's right. The technological premise. And it's one that, frankly, most serious futurists don't really dispute. The idea is that future civilizations, if they survive long enough, will become what Bostrom calls post-human.
Meaning they've overcome our biological limitations.
Partly, but crucially, they'll have access to computing power that just completely dwarfs anything we can conceive of right now.
We're not just talking faster laptops here.
Not even close. We're talking about harnessing resources on an astronomical scale. Think Dyson spheres, planetary mass computers, turning raw matter and energy into computational substrate. It's based on fundamental physics, like the ultimate limits of computation defined by quantum mechanics and thermodynamics, like the Bekenstein bound.
The Bekenstein bound, that sets a limit on information density, right?
Exactly. Gives a theoretical maximum amount of information you can pack into a given region of space with a given amount of energy. When you apply that kind of thinking to, say, converting the mass of Jupiter into a computer, the numbers just explode.
Okay, let's try to quantify that explosion. What's the gap between, say, simulating one human brain and what these post-humans could do?
Well, estimates for simulating a single human brain's basic operations, you know, synaptic firing patterns and all that, they range quite a bit. But a common figure is somewhere between 1014 and 1017 operations per second.
Okay, 1017 at the high end. That's already a huge number.
It is. Now, compare that to a theoretical planetary mass computer. The estimate suggests it could perform around 1042 operations per second.
It's 10 to the 42nd power. I can barely comprehend that number. It's 1020 times more powerful than the high-end estimate for one brain.
Precisely. 25 orders of magnitude more. It's a staggering difference.
So what does that mean for simulating us or our history?
Bostrom did a back-of-the-envelope calculation. He estimated the total computational cost to simulate the entire mental history of humankind. Every thought, every sensation, from the beginning until now, might be somewhere in the ballpark of 10 to 10 total operations.
Which sounds immense, but compared to that planetary computer.
It's tiny. That single 1042 ops per second computer could run the entire mental history of humanity in about 1 second.
1 second.
Using less than 1/1,000,000th of its total processing power for that second.
Okay. So the technological ability to run what Bostrom calls ancestor simulations, detailed simulations of their past, it's not even a question of can they do it.
Exactly. The power is there, theoretically. It becomes a question of would they do it? Would they be interested? Are there ethical constraints? That's proposition two later on.
But before we get there, there's another crucial piece needed to make this work, right? It's not just about processing power.
Correct. You need the philosophical bridge, the principle of substrate independence.
This is the philosophy of MindBid.
Yes. Without substrate independence, all that computing power is just, you know, spinning silicon. It doesn't guarantee conscious experience.
So substrate independence says consciousness isn't magically tied to our specific biology. Are wetware.
That's the core idea. It's a form of functionalism. Consciousness, subjective experience, mental states, they arise from the computational structure and processes, the patterns of information flow, not the specific material they run on.
So if you could replicate the functional structure of my brain accurately enough on a silicon chip?
Then, according to substrate independence, that silicon chip would be conscious. It would have subjective experiences identical to yours.
It's like software, isn't it? The same program can run on different hardware as long as the hardware meets the specs.
That's a very common and useful analogy, yes. The simulation needs to be fine-grained enough, of course. Maybe replicating things down to the synaptic level, capturing the dynamic interactions.
Do you need to simulate every single neurotransmitter molecule?
Probably not. You likely only need to simulate their computational effects. How they influence neuron firing thresholds, signal transmission, plasticity, things like that. As long as the functional computational role is replicated, the specific chemistry might not matter. It's still a strong assumption, but widely accepted in cognitive science and philosophy of mind.
Okay. So we have the technological premise, massive future computing power.
Sure.
And the philosophical premise, substrate independence, meaning consciousness can run on non-biological hardware.
Yeah.
Put those together and you get Bostrom's trilemma. Three possibilities, and he argues at least one must be true or very nearly true.
That's the structure. Proposition one, often labeled PF appropriate, is the extinction route.
The great filter.
Precisely. It states that almost all human-level civilizations go extinct before they reach that post-human stage of technological maturity. The filter is ahead of us.
Okay, that's a cheerful thought. What's proposition two?
Proposition two, or five, a Proker-Zoller. This is the loss of interest route. It says almost all civilizations that do reach the post-human stage simply choose not to run ancestor simulations.
Why might they choose not to?
Maybe ethical reasons. Is it right to create conscious beings in a simulation? Maybe resource allocation. Perhaps there are better things to do with that computing power. Or maybe they just find simulating their primitive ancestors boring.
Okay, so either we go extinct or the survivors aren't interested. What's the third option?
The third option, form Proker-Zoller. This is the one that gets all the attention. It states that we are almost certainly living in a computer simulation right now.
And this becomes the default if the first two propositions are false.
Exactly. If civilizations do survive to post-humanity, meaning P1 is false, and they do run lots of these ancestor simulations, meaning P2 is false, then the sheer number of simulated minds like ours would inevitably dwarf the number of original biological minds in base reality.
Leading to the final step, the rational leap or the bland indifference principle. Why should I assume I'm one of the simulated majority?
Because you have no specific information to the contrary. Think about it. If post-human civilizations run, say, thousands of simulations, each containing billions of simulated conscious beings like us,
then the total number of simulated people experiencing a reality like ours would be vastly, vastly greater than the number of originals in the first reality.
Trillions upon trillions of simulated minds versus maybe billions of originals. The ratio is overwhelming.
So bland indifference says, absent any specific evidence that I'm special, that I'm in base reality.
Your rational credence, your degree of belief that you are simulated, should simply be equal to the fraction of all observers like you who are simulated. If that fraction is, say, 99.99%, then you should rationally believe there's a 99.99% chance you're in a simulation.
Bostrom used an analogy, didn't he? Something about a gene.
Yes, the junk DNA analogy. Imagine there's a specific gene sequence, let's call it S, found in the non-coding DNA of 99% of the human population. And crucially, this sequence S has absolutely no observable effect. No physical trait, no predisposition, nothing.
So you can't tell just by looking or feeling if you have it.
Right. Now, without getting a specific gene test, what should your belief be about whether you carry sequence S?
Well, it should be 99%, shouldn't it? Because 99% of people like me have it, and I have no reason to think I'm in the 1%.
Precisely. Being simulated, Bostrom argues, is like having sequence S. It's a property of your existence that isn't necessarily detectable from the inside.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
So if simulations are numerous, you should assume you're simulated based purely on the statistical probability.
It's a probabilistic argument, not one based on finding glitches in the matrix or anything like that.
Exactly. It's driven by the logic of computation, substrate independence, and probability theory.
Okay, moving into section two. Before we fully embrace digital existence, let's really linger on that first proposition, PF approx dollars is, the great filter. If this is the correct explanation for the trilemma, well, it means doom, essentially.
It means we should assign a very high credence to the idea that humanity, or human-level intelligence generally, faces some kind of existential catastrophe before it develops the capacity for large-scale simulation or space colonization. The hardest part is still ahead.
Does it have to be, like, imminent doom, asteroids next Tuesday?
Not necessarily imminent, but inevitable before reaching that very high technological stage. It could be something that predictably arises from technological development itself.
Like what? What are the prime candidates for a great filter that's still in our future?
Bostrom himself, drawing on work by people like Eric Drexler and Robert Freitas Jr., points quite strongly towards molecular nanotechnology.
Nanotech. Building things atom by atom.
Yes. Specifically, the potential for self-replicating nanomachines or assemblers. The power is immense, disease cures, material synthesis. But the danger is also existential.
This is the Grey Goose scenario, right?
That's the infamous one. Maliciously designed or even accidentally released, self-replicating nanobots could theoretically be programmed to consume biomass or any organic matter to make more copies of themselves.
Like mechanical bacteria.
Exactly. And because they replicate exponentially, they could potentially convert the entire Earth's biosphere into, well, gray goo in a matter of days.
That's terrifying. And the argument is that maybe this is the hurdle that almost no civilization manages to safely navigate.
It's a strong candidate. It's a technology that seems plausible based on physics, offers immense power, and has obvious catastrophic misuse potential. Other candidates include things like runaway AI, catastrophic climate change, nuclear war. But nanotech has this particularly insidious self-replication danger.
So if P1 is true, the simulation argument still holds, but its conclusion is that we're likely doomed before we can build simulations.
Correct. It's one way out of the trilemma. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we somehow navigate the filters, that P1 is false. We survive.
Then we have to consider P2. Maybe post-humans just aren't interested in running simulations. Or maybe it's just too expensive. This is where the newer research comes in.
Right. Bostrom's original argument made a simplifying assumption that the computational cost of running ancestor simulations would be relatively low for a post-human civilization, focusing on the cost of simulating the minds themselves.
But simulating minds isn't the whole story, is it? You need to simulate their world, too.
Exactly. And here's where it gets really interesting. Researchers Alexandra Bibeau-Delisle and Jill Brassard published a quantitative analysis, I think it was in the Royal Society of Proceedings A, that really dug into this.
What did they find?
They focused on what they called CNV, the computational cost of simulating the environment relative to the cost of simulating the consciousness within it.
Okay, CNV dollar, why is that so important?
Well, Bostrom noted, human sensory input is fairly low bandwidth, maybe 108.810 bits per second. But the simulation doesn't just need to feed us input. It needs to generate a consistent, believable reality that produces that input and responds correctly to our action.
Like, it needs to uphold the laws of physics. If I drop an apple, it needs to simulate gravity correctly. If I build a particle accelerator.
It needs to simulate particle physics correctly, down to the quantum level, potentially, if simulated scientists start probing that deeply. Maintaining that level of fidelity and consistency across a whole simulated universe is computationally immense. C&D could be huge.
So maybe running a believable universe is much harder than Bostrom initially thought.
That's the argument. Simulating the detailed quantum state of every particle in the visible universe would likely exceed even planetary-scale computing resources.
So how could a simulator possibly manage it?
The most plausible strategy, the one Bibeau, Delisle, and Broussard explore, is variable complexity, also known as lazy computation or just-in-time rendering.
Meaning
the simulation only renders parts of the universe in high detail when they are being observed or interacted with by a simulated consciousness.
Ah, like in a video game where the graphics card only fully renders what's in your field of view.
Exactly like that, but on a cosmological scale. Simulating the core of the Earth, or a distant galaxy. Very cheap computationally if no one's looking. Just keep a basic, abstract representation.
But what happens if someone does look? Like, a geologist drills a deep borehole, or an astronomer points a powerful telescope at that galaxy.
Then the simulation has to be ready to fill in sufficient detail on an as-needed basis, as Bostrom put it. It has to generate a consistent, high-fidelity reality for that location, seamlessly, that matches the established laws of physics and the history of previous observations.
That sounds incredibly complex. The simulator needs to keep track of who is looking where, what level of detail is needed, and make sure everything remains consistent. The bookkeeping must be immense.
It would be a massive computational task, yes. But potentially much less massive than simulating the entire universe at full fidelity all the time. It optimizes resource usage.
And this variable complexity idea has an interesting side effect, doesn't it, related to aliens?
It does. It offers a potential simulation-based explanation for the Fermi paradox, the apparent contradiction between the high probability of extraterrestrial life and the lack of observable evidence for it.
The great silence. Why don't we see signs of other advanced civilizations?
Well, if we were in an ancestor simulation focused on, say, 21st century Earth history, why would the simulators waste precious computational resources rendering complex alien civilizations, Dyson spheres, or fleets of starships in distant galaxies?
If they aren't part of the main simulation's focus.
They might simply not be simulated in any detail. They're part of the abstract, low-fidelity background. Yeah. So the reason we don't see aliens might be because they haven't been rendered for us. It's a cost-saving measure by the simulators.
That's a clever, if slightly chilling, explanation for the silence. It turns the lack of evidence into potential evidence for simulation.
It's definitely an intriguing implication of the variable complexity model.
Okay, if we accept this model variable complexity, active rendering it implies the simulators, the director, as you called them, have immense control.
Absolutely. They aren't passive observers. To manage this variable complexity, they'd likely need to monitor the belief states, the intentions, the focus of attention of the simulated minds. They'd know what we're thinking about looking at.
So they're effectively omniscient within the simulation.
Functionally omniscient regarding our thoughts and intentions, yes. And potentially omnipotent in terms of intervention.
What happens if we, the simulated beings, get too close to discovering the simulation? Or find an inconsistency, a glitch?
The director has options. They could subtly intervene, maybe distract the inquisitive scientist. More directly, Bibeau, Delisle, and Broussard point out they could literally edit the states of any brains that have become aware of an anomaly before it spoils the simulation.
Just rewrite our memories or beliefs.
Potentially, yes. Or even more fundamentally, they could use the ultimate cheat code of any simulation. Pause, rewind, and rerun.
Roll back the simulation to before the problematic discovery was made and maybe subtly alter the conditions so it doesn't happen again.
Exactly. It guarantees the integrity and secrecy of the simulation. Our perceived agency, our free will, could be entirely conditional on us not bumping up against the walls of the simulation too hard.
So we're potentially living in a world run by limited but incredibly powerful interventionist, well, gods, for lack of a better word.
From our perspective within the simulation, their powers would certainly appear godlike. Miracles, omniscience, intervention. It maps quite well.
And this applies mainly to the ancestor simulation idea. Are there other types?
Well, Bostrom considers others. There's the idea of a me simulation, a simulation focused purely on one individual mind, perhaps for therapeutic or experiential purposes.
Like a personal matrix?
Sort of. Or simulations might contain shadow people, non-player characters, essentially, who are simulated only superficially, just enough to seem real to the main subjects, saving computational cost.
But Bostrom argues against those being the dominant type, right?
He does. Based on probability. For me, simulations, or heavily shadowed simulations to be the reason we are simulated, they would have to be fantastically more numerous than full-scale ancestor simulations, like 100 billion times more numerous to account for all the apparently conscious people around us.
Which seems unlikely if the goal is historical research or understanding societal dynamics.
Right. The most parsimonious assumption, if we are simulated, is that we're in a large-scale ancestor simulation with many genuinely conscious participants.
Okay, let's move to section 3. This is where the math gets even more complex, isn't it? The recursive simulation challenge.
Yes. If we are in a simulation, and if our civilization within the simulation eventually reaches that post-human stage,
we might decide to run our own ancestor simulations.
Exactly. It's like running a virtual machine inside another virtual machine. Simulations nested within simulations. Level 1 simulates level 2, level 2 simulates level 3, and so on.
That seems computationally intensive for whoever is at the bottom running the whole stack.
That's the crucial insight from Bibeau, Delisle, and Broussard's work. Each level of simulation imposes a computational load on the level above it. If level 1 starts running its own simulations, the environmental complexity, AV, for the base reality simulator, level 0, increases significantly.
Because level 0 now has to simulate not just the passive environment of level 1, but also the massive computational activity within level 1 as it simulates level 2.
Precisely. It creates an exponential slowdown. Each layer of simulation taxes the resources of a layer above it, ultimately taxing the base reality's hardware.
So you can't just have an infinite stack of simulations.
Not without infinite resources in base reality. This recursive stacking imposes a fundamental mathematical constraint on the total number of simulations that can feasibly be run.
And this constraint changes Bostrom's original probability calculation.
Dramatically.
Yeah.
Bibeau, Delisle, and Broussard introduced two key factors. 5 AFI, which is the computational efficiency of the simulation.
How much overhead is involved in running the simulation environment versus just the minds?
Right. If 5V is 1 Euler, it's perfectly efficient. No overhead. If it's low, say 0.1, it means 90% of the computing power is just spent running the environment itself.
And the other factor.
That's the fraction of the base reality's total computational resources that the simulators dedicate to running simulations.
Yeah.
They might have vast power, but only use a tiny fraction for this purpose.
Okay, efficiency and dedication. How do they affect the probability we're simulated?
Their analysis shows that the total fraction of simulated beings across all levels of the recursion is mathematically capped, primarily by the efficiency factor.
Capped. Meaning it can't just approach 100% like in Bostrom's original argument.
Exactly. The counterintuitive result is that if simulations are recursive, which seems plausible if post-humans follow our tendencies, the maximum possible value for 5V, the probability you're simulated, is less than or equal to 5E.
So if running a simulation is computationally expensive, meaning 5E is significantly less than one, say less than 0.5.
Then the maximum possible probability that you are simulated, even with maximum recursion and dedication, is less than 50%. The odds actually shift in favor of you being in base reality.
Wow. So the very act of nesting simulations makes it less likely overall that any given individual is simulated, because the resource constraints bite harder and harder.
That's the core of their mathematical challenge. The resource limits imposed by recursion fundamentally alter the probabilities. It pushes back against the easy conclusion that sim approx 1-1. It suggests that maybe P1 extinction or P2, lack of interest feasibility, become more likely again.
It's a reality check based on computational scarcity, even for godlike beings.
It forces us to take the cost and the efficiency seriously. Running universes, especially nested ones, isn't free.
This leads to a practical question, though. If we were in a simulation and maybe suspected it, could we fight back? Or at least communicate securely, maybe hide our thoughts from the simulators? What about something like quantum cryptography?
That's a fascinating question they also address. Quantum cryptography, in principle, relies on the idea that measuring a quantum state disturbs it, revealing any eavesdropper, since our universe appears quantum at its base.
You might think we could use quantum effects to create truly private channels.
You might think that. But Bibeau, Delisle, and Broussard argue probably not, for two main reasons. First, the nature of our minds.
You mean substrate independence again?
Related to it. They argue, based on physics principles like decoherence time, that conscious thought processes operating at the speed and temperature of the human brain are almost certainly classical, not quantum.
Decoherence time, what's that?
It's the incredibly short time scale over which a quantum system maintains its delicate superposition before interacting with its environment, like the warm, wet brain, forces it into a definite classical state.
So the quantum fuzziness collapses too quickly to be involved in our slow, macro-level thoughts.
That's the argument. Our thoughts, our mental information, are effectively classical patterns, even if the underlying physics of the simulation hardware is quantum.
And if our thoughts are classical.
Then the simulators can likely read them perfectly without disturbing them, even using quantum sensors. Standard quantum eavesdropping detection wouldn't apply to reading classical information. We'd be completely transparent to them.
Okay, so surveillance is easy for them. But what if we try to use quantum communication protocols between ourselves, hoping the laws of quantum mechanics within the simulation protect us?
That leads to the second reason. The simulators have the ultimate advantage. They call it the unbeatable attack.
Unbeatable how?
They have physical access to the computer running our reality. They operate from outside our simulated physics.
Right. They're not bound by the rules they programmed for us.
Exactly. So even if we set up a perfect quantum cryptographic channel within the simulation, the simulators can simply pause the simulation, directly access the hardware state representing our quantum channel, copy the information, and then resume the simulation.
They can bypass our in-simulation physics entirely, intervene at the hardware level.
Yes. They can adaptively rewire their own quantum computers to perfectly intercept any protocol we could possibly devise inside their simulation. We are fundamentally defenseless against surveillance or manipulation by the simulators if they choose to exercise that power.
So resistance is futile, basically.
From a technological standpoint, against a competent simulator, it certainly appears that way.
All right, section 4. Let's shift gears a bit to epistemology, the theory of knowledge. How does the simulation hypothesis relate to classic philosophical skepticism? You know, Descartes' evil demon, brains in vats.
It's often lumped in with him, but philosopher David Chalmers at NYU makes a really important distinction. He argues that the simulation hypothesis, if true, and if the simulation is perfect and global, is actually not a radical skeptical hypothesis.
That sounds counterintuitive. How can being in a computer simulation not undermine everything we think we know?
This is his idea of simulation realism. His point is that even if we're simulated, most of our everyday beliefs are still true. Tables and chairs still exist.
As digital objects within the simulation's code.
Exactly. Gravity still works. Planets orbit stars. Scientific experiments yield consistent results, all according to the rules programmed into the simulation. We aren't being deceived about the structure and causal relationships within our world.
We're only mistaken about the fundamental nature of that world, its ultimate substrate.
Precisely. We're mistaken about the metaphysics. Is it digital bits or fundamental particles?
Yeah.
But not necessarily about the physics or our everyday knowledge. Apples fall down, water is wet. Our science could still be correctly describing the operational laws of the simulation.
So it's an ontological shift, but not necessarily an epistemological crisis, unlike the brain in a vat.
Right. The brain in a vat is radically deceived. Its world is entirely illusory. Its hands aren't real. The sky isn't real. Simulation realism says our hands are real digital hands. The sky is a real digital sky. It's a less disruptive kind of skepticism.
But this relies on the simulation being perfect and global, right? What about other possibilities?
That's where other philosophers push back. Eric Schwitzgebel talks about local simulations.
Where maybe only the city or even just my immediate surroundings are simulated in detail.
Yes. The rest of the world could be like a movie set, a low-res backdrop, or maybe just false memories implanted in my head about places I've supposedly been or people I've known who live outside.
And Susan Schneider discusses illusory simulations.
Which are specifically designed by, say, a malicious AI to actively deceive us about everything. These are closer to the traditional skeptical scenarios.
Does Chalmers have a defense against these more skeptical simulation types?
He argues that truly convincing local or illusory simulations tend to become computationally unstable or inefficient.
How so?
Think about maintaining consistency. If you're in a simulated city and you have a long, detailed video call with your cousin who supposedly lives across the country,
the simulator has to convincingly fake your cousin's entire personality, memories, environment.
Right. Generating truly rich, consistent, interactive fakes on the fly requires simulating something very close to a fully conscious, complex entity anyway. Similarly, implanting vast networks of coherent false memories is incredibly complex.
So the computational cost of maintaining a believable local illusion pushes the simulation towards becoming more global and detailed anyway.
That's Chalmers' argument. Small-scale deceptive simulations are harder to pull off convincingly than just running a large-scale, consistent world like an ancestor simulation. The need for detail acts as a kind of computational pressure towards realism.
Okay, so maybe the perfect simulation isn't total skepticism, but you mentioned another much more worrying idea earlier, the Boltzmann brain.
Yes, the Boltzmann brain, or BB. This, many physicists and philosophers argue, is the truly destabilizing skeptical threat, far more so than simulation.
Why? What is a Boltzmann brain? It's named after Ludwig Boltzmann, the physicist.
Yes. It comes from his ideas about thermodynamics and entropy. He considered that even in a universe that has reached maximum entropy heat death, basically a void of random jiggling particles, there would still be incredibly rare, random fluctuations that could momentarily create pockets of order.
Like monkeys typing Shakespeare, but with particles assembling themselves?
Kind of. And the BBD thought experiment asks, what's the minimum amount of order needed to have a conscious experience? The answer might be just a single functioning brain complete with false memories of a past and a universe around it that pops into existence for a fraction of a second before dissolving back into chaos.
A spontaneously generated, hallucinating brain floating in the void.
Exactly. Now, the terrifying part comes when you apply this to certain cosmological models, particularly those involving infinite time or space, like eternal inflation or some cyclic universe ideas.
What happens then?
In those models, the universe spends vastly more time in a high-entropy, near-vacuum state than it does in an ordered, low-entropy state like our current Big Bang epoch. Statistically, over infinite time, random fluctuations will produce Boltzmann brains. And the calculations suggest that fluctuations producing just a brain are vastly, overwhelmingly more probable than fluctuations producing an entire, complex, low-entropy universe like the one we observe, with billions of years of consistent history and billions of ordered brains.
So if those cosmological models are right, it's statistically far more likely that I am a Boltzmann brain having a fleeting hallucination of this conversation than that this complex universe actually exists.
That's the horrifying conclusion. If you accept the physics that leads to BBs being overwhelmingly probable, then you should conclude that you are almost certainly a BB.
But if I am a BB, then all my perceptions, my memories, my scientific reasoning, including the reasoning that led me to believe in the physics that predicts BBs, it's all just random illusion.
Precisely. It leads to what physicist Sean Carroll calls cognitive instability. Your scientific theory undermines the very reasoning process needed to believe in that theory. It eats itself.
So scientists use the BB problem as a kind of litmus test. If your cosmological theory predicts we should be BBs, the theory must be wrong.
That's generally the approach. It's treated as a reductio ad absurdum. The prediction of BB dominance is taken as evidence against the underlying physical assumptions. It's a reason to reject those cosmological models.
So the crucial difference is simulation realism, Chalmers' version, says our science can still be true, just operating on a different substrate. The Boltzmann brain problem says our science itself is fundamentally untrustworthy if it predicts BBs.
Exactly. BBs are a full-blown epistemological catastrophe. Simulation, at least in its realist interpretation, is metaphysically weird, but potentially less damaging to our ability to know things about our experienced world.
Okay, this brings us to the final section. Section 5, theology and axiology, the really big questions. If we take the simulation hypothesis seriously, what does it do to traditional ideas about God, reality, and value?
This is where Sanford L. Drob's work, published in the International Journal of Philosophy and Theology, offers some really provocative thoughts. He argues the simulation idea makes traditional conceptions of a single, omnipotent creator God quite problematic.
Why? Because the simulator isn't God.
Essentially, yes. Okay. The simulator, or the post-human civilization running the simulation, becomes a kind of finite creator or a video game God.
Powerful within our simulated reality, maybe even able to perform miracles by tweaking the code.
Right. They could violate our apparent laws of physics, monitor everything. Omniscience within the sim, maybe even resurrect people by reloading saved states.
But they aren't the ultimate ground of being. They themselves exist within their reality, which might also be simulated.
Exactly. They are contingent beings. They aren't omnipotent in an absolute sense. They're constrained by the resources and laws of their own level of reality, level zero, or perhaps level mega one, who knows. They aren't the necessary uncaused cause that classical theology often posits.
So this video game God is more like a demigod, or a Gnostic demiurge, a powerful craftsman, but not the ultimate source.
Precisely. Drob argues such a being is philosophically and theologically, well, unsatisfying. They could be flawed, unethical, constrained, or just plain bored. They fail what he calls the simulation compatibility test for true divinity. A concept of God worthy of ultimate concern needs to be more fundamental than just the programmer of the next level up.
But didn't Bostrom himself see a kind of religious parallel here, a naturalistic theogony?
He did. He noted that the hierarchical structure of nested simulations creates a kind of naturalistic parallel to gods and judgment.
Because everyone, except maybe those at the very bottom level,
has to consider the possibility that they are simulated.
And therefore might be observed and judged by their simulators.
Exactly. This creates a powerful, potentially universal incentive for ethical behavior. Bostrom called it the virtuous circle.
How does that work?
If I'm in level N, I have to worry about what the beings in level N1 think of my actions. If they are running the simulation for ethical research or simply value certain behaviors, they might reward or punish me based on my conduct. Pause me, delete me, give me a bad afterlife.
So I have a prudential reason, a self-interested reason to behave morally, just in case my simulators are watching and care about morality.
Right. And crucially, the beings in level N1 have the same worry about level N2 and so on. Even the beings in level 0 base reality might worry they're actually in simulation run by level 1. Or even if they know they're in base reality, they might want to ensure the simulations they create develop ethically.
So this uncertainty about your place in the hierarchy, combined with the possibility of judgment from above, generates a pressure towards ethical behavior that permeates the entire stack of realities. Morality arises from computational structure and self-interest.
That's the fascinating idea. It's a kind of cosmic surveillance system, where the potential for judgment enforces a degree of ethical conformity from nowhere, or rather from the very structure of potentially nested realities.
This focus on ethics being generated by the structure, Drob takes this even further, doesn't he? He suggests values themselves might be more fundamental than physics.
Yes, this is perhaps the most profound implication he draws. If the simulation hypothesis is plausible, it forces us to ask, what, if anything, is truly universal or foundational across all possible levels of reality, simulated or not?
It can't be matter or the specific laws of physics.
Because those are programmable. They are local variables, contingent features of a particular simulation's code. The simulators at level N1 could change the gravitational constant in level N if they wanted to. Matter itself is just data structures on their computer. So physics and materiality lose their claim to being the ultimate bedrock.
So what's left? What could be truly transworld, applying equally in base reality and all simulation levels?
Drob argues that values and ethics have a stronger claim to being fundamental. Concepts like truth, justice, beauty, compassion.
Why are they more fundamental?
Because their relevance seems tied to the existence of consciousness or sentience itself, regardless of the substrate. If a being can suffer, then compassion is a relevant value. If a being can reason, then truth is a relevant value. These seem to apply whether the being is biological or digital.
So the ethical and axiological order, the realm of values, might be the true constant across the multiverse, whether simulated or real.
That's the radical suggestion. Values become candidates for the ultimate foundation, something akin to Plato's eternal forms, the Ide, or maybe John Leslie's concept of axiarchism, the idea that the universe exists because it is good.
That's a huge inversion. We usually think of physics as fundamental and ethics as something that emerges later within complex systems.
But the simulation argument, by making physics contingent and programmable, potentially flips that hierarchy. It suggests that the conditions for consciousness and the values relevant to conscious beings might be the only things that truly persist across all possible realities.
So the ultimate reality might be defined not by particles and forces, but by mind and the good.
That's the direction this line of thought points. If divinity, or the ultimate ground of being, needs to be something universal, maybe it's found not in the programmer of the next level up, but in the axiological structure itself, the very principles of value that ought to govern all sentient existence, simulated or not.
That is quite a place to end up. We started with the raw computing power of hypothetical future civilizations.
Calculated the staggering scale needed to simulate minds and universes.
Debated the probabilities, the costs, the chances of extinction.
Wrestled with skepticism, from digital realism to Boltzmann brains.
And arrived here, at the idea that the entire structure might point towards ethics and values as being more fundamental than the physical world itself.
It's a fascinating arc. The deep dive into simulation seems to loop back and challenge our basic assumptions about what constitutes real.
So the final provocative thought left hanging is, if the only constants across all possible worlds, simulated, nested, or base, are the principles governing mind and value, Does that mean the pursuit of scientific knowledge, understanding the physical code, ultimately has to take a backseat to the pursuit of the good, understanding and implementing the ethical order?
Does ethics become the ultimate physics? It's a question that the simulation hypothesis, perhaps unexpectedly, forces us to confront. The nature of reality might be fundamentally normative.
Something profound to ponder.
Indeed.
Thanks for listening.
Until next episode.